couple years ago, I had the privilege of teaching a Sunday school out of the book of Genesis. And the Lord really did a work in my life from that study. And two people who are in that class are here today, Tom and Kelly Harmon. And they are just beginning their adventure as they are seeking God's will and actually pursuing going to Tanzania. And so Kelly is Bee's granddaughter. And so definitely keep them in your prayers. But as I came to Mount Morris Community Church, and you've already heard from me, my heart as why we're studying the book of Genesis. You can't really understand a book unless you understand how it begins. And I believe that the book of Genesis sets the foundation for the themes for the rest of the Old Testament and definitely the New Testament. And last week, we looked at one of, for me, one of the hardest texts to preach through because it's a genealogy. And as we're trying to progressively go through this book, last week we came to chapter 10, and I'll admit there was part of me wanting to kind of just say, well, we'll just go right to chapter 11. Because chapter 10 is those genealogies, those Bible, read through the year Bible busters, as I mentioned. You get to them and we kind of just want to glaze over them a little bit. But hopefully last week we were reminded that these portions of Scripture are not just randomly placed there or just there for show or for other reasons. It actually figures into all of Scripture. It's foundational to our understanding of Scripture. It's foundational to understanding Genesis. And so last week we opened, as was our usual practice, by observing the author's use of repetition. Last week, by the way, you may notice in your bulletin a very familiar insert because it's identical to last week's. If you remember, last week I got through point one. And now we're hopefully going to get through points two and three, but I don't know about you, but as a week, as we go through a week, as we progress through a week, I forget. And I'm the one that taught it. So I forget everything. So what we're going to do is we're going to start off today, kind of the introduction is going to be just summarizing last week's sermon. So let's look at Genesis chapter 10, and we're just going to walk through it. We noted how the sons of Noah, by the way, can we name the sons of Noah? Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Okay, very good. And we've been tracing this narrative. We've been tracing from Adam, and we've gone through to Seth, to Cain. We've gone through all these different various people, and we've arrived at this man named Noah. We know that Noah built the ark. God sent a flood. He destroyed the wickedness of the earth. And Noah emerges from the ark with his family. And as we get into Genesis chapter 9, we see that Noah is kind of depicted as a new Adam or another Adam. He is having dominion over the earth, and he's reigning over it. And we see that mankind, even though he is like a new Adam, we still see that like Adam, Noah is sinful. Noah is a sinner. Genesis 9:6, we see that God has to give a warning about murder. And he says, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. So we see here that as they come out of the ark, even though Noah is depicted as a new Adam, he is still shown to be sinful. All humanity still is sinful. And boy, don't we see that when we get to Noah planting a vineyard. And as Adam fell by taking a fruit and using it for selfish consumption, we see the same thing happening with Noah. As he takes a fruit, the wine. He makes wine and he gets drunk using it for selfish consumption. And as Adam was shown to be shamed by nakedness after the fall, Noah here is lying in the tent naked and shamed. And so, along walks his son Ham. And Ham walks by the tent and sees his father in his nakedness. And instead of showing respect to his father, Ham runs and tells the other two brothers about their father's condition. And the other two brothers, Shem and Japheth, they go to their father's tent, but instead of acting like Ham, they actually turn themselves so they don't see the nakedness of their father, and they provide a covering for Noah. And I believe we're reminded there of the covering God brought to Adam after his sin. But because of this, Noah, he wakes up from his drunken stupor, and he pronounces blessing and curse. And the blessing is upon specifically whom? Shem. And by association, Japheth is also blessed. But there's also a curse, and that is the curse of who was cursed? No. Canaan. I did that intentionally. I'm sorry. I did that intentionally. Sorry. We look at Ham, and Noah does not curse specifically Ham, but a coming descendant of Ham. And that man is Canaan. So when we get to Genesis chapter 10, we've been tracing narrative, we've been tracing a storyline, we've been tracing chronology, and when we get to Genesis chapter 10, chronology has been suspended for a little while. Because the author's primary intent from here, or right here, is not narrative. Kind of, okay? I'm going to say that, I guess. But it's not really chronology at this point. He is focusing on a genealogy. And as we looked last week, verse 1 acts as the introduction of chapter 10, and verse 32 acts as the conclusion. But in the middle, we have three main points. And as I joked last week, it's a preacher's dream. Three main points in the text. But point one, we could say, would be the lineage of the sons of Japheth, or the offspring of enlargement, as we looked at letter A in your outline. We notice that Japheth would be the father of the Gentile nations. He's going to spread eventually into Asia Minor and Europe. But Japheth is blessed because of his association with Ham. Excuse me, with Shem. Wow. You need to know what I mean, not what I say. Okay? It's kind of a parent thing. Don't go by what I say, go by what I mean. But then, point number two, we could look in this outline as the offspring of enslavement. And we say it's the offspring of enslavement because in Genesis chapter 9, when Cain is cursed, in verse 25, it says, "Cursed be Cain, a servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." And we talked last week about how some people in history have used this curse as a way to legitimize slavery. But really, we looked last week to see that a better understanding of what it means to be a servant of servants is not really slavery, but being conquered. So there's a coming offspring here, a curse of Cain, who will be conquered. By whom? Well, they will be the servants of his brothers, specifically Shem. So there's the offspring of enlargement. There's the offspring of enslavement. And then there's the offspring, we said, of enrichment. And that, of course, is the blessed offspring. And we see that in verse 26 of chapter 9. It says, "He also said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." So there we have once again Shem being and his offspring being depicted as the offspring of enrichment or blessing, while Ham, or specifically I should say Canaan, as the cursed. And that is where we kind of left off. However, look down in verse 15 of Genesis 10. While going through the sons of Ham in verses 6 all the way to 14, the author really narrows our focus to the cursed offspring. And we see from Canaan that he is the father of the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, and all the other ites that we will see to be in the land when Joshua finally crosses the Jordan River. But if we go on down to verse 21, we see that Shem has a title. What is the title of Shem in verse 21? The father of whom? The children of Eber. And we remarked last week how Eber actually is the father of the Hebrew nation. And how, as we start the lineage of Shem, the author is immediately giving us a focused phrase that we need to look for as we continue in this lineage. We see here that he's the father of the children of Eber. Why would he say that right away? Well, because he wants us to really know when Eber comes. And so let's look in verse 24. Now, if you remember, there was a name last week that I refused to try to pronounce. And verse 24 starts off with that name. So once again, I'll refuse. You guys could probably pronounce it better than me. I've tried many times sitting at my desk to pronounce that name, and it never comes out well. So that person fathered Shelah, and Shelah fathered Eber. And we find that Eber had two sons, and their names were Peleg and Joktan. Okay? But we see something that happens in verse 25. To Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. That little phrase there gives us a marker of narrative. And what I mean by that is in Genesis, our main text for today, in Genesis chapter 11, we are going to read about the Tower of Babel, where God scatters or divides the earth. And we can see here, I personally believe, that in verse 25, we are seeing that in the days of Peleg and Joktan, that the earth is divided. That is where the Tower of Babel takes place. So, if you notice something really interesting, there's two sons to come from Eber, Peleg and Joktan, or whatever you want to say. And Joktan, verse 26, fathered, and we see his lineage. Who is left out of this lineage? Peleg. We see two sons mentioned here. And we're only, after mentioning these two sons, do we follow one. And so at the end of chapter 10, as readers, we should be thinking, well, wait a minute, what about Peleg? We know he has two sons. We've been tracing lineage. We've been tracing all of these things. Why is the author not telling us about Peleg? Well, hold that question, and let's go into, in your outline, point two, the dispersal of the nations. Point number two, the dispersal of the nations. So now we're in chapter 11, and the author is now returning to chronology. We've suspended lineage for a little bit, and now we're back at chronology. From Ham's line, we focused on the curse line of Canaan, from their clans, cities, and lands. However, we only have partial information about Shem's line. We've traced the two lines to two very important men, Peleg and Joktan, and learned a lot about Joktan's line. But we know nothing of Peleg's line. But let's read here our text in verse 1. Scripture says, now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. How many of you, your text says asphalt? Okay, a few of you. Yeah, that's accurate. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its tops in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. Let's stop right there. First off, we see letter A, a depiction of an undivided people. An undivided people, the whole earth had one language. Those two words, whole earth, I personally believe means all humanity at this time. The whole earth had one language and the same words. Does that sound repetitive there? Well, what do we know about repetition? It's quite important to Hebrew literature, isn't it? The whole earth had one language and the same words. They were an undivided people. All the people, kingdoms, and languages before Peleg are players in the story of the Tower of Babel. We see a unity, number one, of language. And the author makes a point to show that the whole earth had one language and the same words. But there's also another unity, and that's the unity of habitation. Look at verse 2. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. Remember, we talked about the repetition of the idea of migrating east. Adam and Eve, when they were kicked out of the garden, what direction did they go? East. When God cursed Cain and said, Cain, you are to be a wanderer. Instead, Cain rebels. And what does he do? He goes and settles a city in what direction? East. And now we have all of the earth depicted here migrating what direction to the land of Shinar? East. And as we see Abraham and Lot later, their herdsmen are not getting along. You guys remember this from last week? Their herdsmen are not getting along at all. And so Abram says, I give you the land before you. You pick the direction. Whatever way you go, I'll go the other. What direction did Lot go? East. But we see here, there's the unity of language and there's a unity of habitation. And they're all in this land of Shinar. What do we know about the land of Shinar from last week? It's a plain, as shown here. But there were many cities established by that man that we love to say his name, Nimrod. You guys remember Nimrod? He wasn't just some idiot in junior high. What a Nimrod. Okay, no. He was a real historical character, but he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. You remember that? Not saying that he was a mighty sportsman, but rather that he was a conqueror. And we see all of these cities come about because of Nimrod, and they settle in the land of Shinar. But not only is there a unity of language and a unity of habitation, there's also a unity of purpose. Look at verse 3. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. There is a common unity of purpose. Under the auspices of community, all the people join together to make a city and a tower. Both could be viewed as one entity that could accomplish a unified aim. Both were constructed with strong materials and a strong specific goal. What was the goal? First off, I believe it's in your notes there. There is a desire for a new dominion. Boy, that word should be loaded to us, shouldn't it? When God told Adam and Eve in the garden, what was his first command? Be fruitful and multiply. But he also said, have what? Dominion. And the idea of having dominion is closely associated with being fruitful and multiplying. And what? Filling the earth. When Noah emerges from the ark, what does God say to Noah and his offspring? Be fruitful, multiply, and to fill the earth. And when we get to Genesis chapter 11, are they filling the earth? No. What are they doing? They're saying, let's build us a city, a tower, lest we be scattered. There's a desire for a new dominion, and if it's not to be filling the earth, where is their new dominion? Well, what are they doing? They're building a tower. They wanted to build, now don't think of an old a song, a stairway to heaven. They wanted to build, literally, a tower that could reach into the heavens. Not to be scattered on the earth. They said, let's build a tower lest we be scattered. Instead, the text indicates a desire to reach heaven. God gave humans the earth to live and to reflect his glory, but humans universally here are desiring to once again be the determiners of the good. Boy, we're only 11 chapters into this book. And don't we see this being a repetitive problem? Humanity is constantly desiring to be the determiners of the good. But there's also a desire for a new status. A new status. Let's look in verse 4 again. They said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its tops in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves. Not only did they want to reach the heavens, but all humanity wanted to make a name. I believe this personally joins with the motive of that man Nimrod, who was a mighty hunter before the Lord and desired to subjugate humanity. As he organized and ruled humans, they acted as one to defy God, and together they worked to determine their own destiny. You know what's really interesting, and I didn't realize this till I was studying. Does anybody know what the name Shem means? Shem, there's a couple different ideas, but Shem or shame actually means name. So let's take these ideas and put them together. We were in Genesis chapter 10. And we see that in verse 21, there's a lineage of Shem, or name. His name means name, okay? And the idea here is that God is making, through the lineage, a name for himself. And we get to Genesis chapter 11. They say, come, let us build ourselves a city and its tower to reach the heavens, and let us make a shame for ourselves. And we get into Genesis chapter 12. If you can flip there, go ahead. Go to Genesis chapter 12. Now, this is the Abrahamic covenant. Look at verse 1. Now, the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your house, your father's house, to a land that I will show you. Not depicted as migrating east, but to go to a land that God shows. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your shame great. The idea of making a name is actually a repetitive idea. The name Shem means name. The Hebrew reader would understand the author has been tracing the distinguished line of a man whose name means name. As we get into chapter 11, we find that the motive for building the city and the tower was for the rebellious people to build for themselves a name. And after God will thwart their name-building plan, the author returns to the lineage of Shem. Look at verse 10 of chapter 11. So once God thwarts their name-building plan, we go back to Genesis chapter 11, and immediately we're confronted with lineage again. But whose? Names, Shem. And the author is going to trace the blessed line ending with the man Terah, who has three sons. So, we see that there is a desire for a new dominion. There's a desire for a new status. But there's also a desire for a new authority. A desire for a new authority. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 11, verse 4. Then they said, come, let us make build ourselves a city and a tower with its tops in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be, what? Dispersed over the face of the whole earth. Folks, at the beginning, God told humans to fill the earth. After the flood, God commanded man to multiply and to fill the earth. However, Genesis 11 shows humans working to stay in a central location. They wanted the control. They wanted to control when and where they went instead of following God's design. You know, I think here we see glimmers of Cain's motivation for settling a city. God told Cain that he was to be a wanderer, but instead, what does Cain do? What does Cain do? He goes and settles, makes a city. Folks, we see this repetition of Adam falling, Cain, his offspring, falling and continuing in rebellion. And we think maybe this flood will cure us of this. But it doesn't, because we see the same patterns reoccurring over and over again. Now, I need to stop here just for a second. I strive not to be a preacher who attempts to remove the text from the context in order to make an application. However, I want us to pause for a moment and attempt to see how this story of one people uniting together to make a name for themselves may apply to us today. We can look at Cain's offspring exiting east of Eden to build himself a kingdom that is shown to be marked by an offspring that is anti-God. As time progresses after Cain and before the flood, God looks down and sees a united people whose thoughts and intentions of the heart was only evil continually. Now, after the flood, all humanity is once again depicted as a united force attempting to find a new status, dominion, and authority. Folks, have we learned our lesson? Has humanity learned their lesson and no longer seeks to unify for such aspirations? Maybe this sounds familiar to you. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us as the world will live as one. Take that as you will. Letter B. A divine inspection. A divine inspection. Look at verse 5. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down, and there confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech. I personally believe that verse 5 uses ironic or perhaps even sarcastic language. As humans are depicted as attempting to ascend, we see here that God is depicted as what? Coming down. This doesn't mean that God was in heaven, unable to see it until he made himself, quote unquote, come down. Instead, it appears to be language to show that humanity could never ascend to God. But look what humanity says. Look at verse 3. Verse 3 says, and they said one to another, come, let us make bricks. Look at verse 4. They said, come, let us. Continuing in verse 4, and let us. But then in verse 7, look what God says. He uses their own words, doesn't he? He says, come, let us go down. We see the author using the same phrasing in God's response to humanity's foolish goals. God says, come, let us go down, and therefore confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. Also, as God says, let us go down, and they're confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech, we see a repeated structure. After Adam and Eve ate of the fruit and were cursed, we see God holding counsel with himself, do we not? You remember this? Adam and Eve, they eat the fruit, and God says something. After Adam and Eve ate the fruit, God speaks to himself and says, behold, the man has become like one of us in knowing good and evil. Now, lest he reach out his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever, let us. The author, I believe, is intentionally linking the two events by the use of repeated themes and phrases. Immediately after seeing that humanity would continue to access the tree of life, God did what? He dispersed them from the garden. And now in Genesis 11, we see that nothing that man purposes to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand one another. So there's a divine inspection, and let us see, there's a divine scattering. Verse 6. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people. If you mark in your Bible, I'm going to circle that one little phrase. We'll come back to it. And they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth. And they left off the building, the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel or Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there, the Lord dispersed them over the face of the earth. God acknowledges that all the people in chapter 10, or the Table of Nations, are one people. Why is that significant? They spoke of the same language, and God confuses their language so they don't understand. With one act, God confounds their abilities, and humanity is left with no other option but to scatter. People who could speak the same language would migrate to various portions of the earth, establishing cities, nations, kingdoms, and gene pools. At this point, people groups would live with one another and as a result produce genetic pools and people groups with these distinct characteristics. All right. We cannot turn on the news without hearing the word racism. And folks, racism has been a problem, I believe, from Babel till today. But there's been some pretty faulty theology that has come from these texts over the years, saying that we can go back even to Cain, and his mark was that he became black. Or we can go to the curse of Canaan and try, as we've already mentioned before, how people have used that to give validity to slavery. But folks, as we look here in verse 6, we see that all of us, all humans, have a common ancestry that go back to Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And we can go back even further to Adam and Eve. This account proves that there are not many races. All variations of skin color and other distinction come about through reproduction within the same gene pools. Skin color is simply a distinction of the amount of melanin in the skin. In a sense, light-skinned people have the dark genes bred out of them. Darker-skinned people have the light genes bred out of them. The only way to reintroduce diversity into the gene pool is to mate with others with different genetic varieties. Therefore, all people groups are one race. There are not many races, only one, and that's the human race. All men are come from Adam and are made in the image of God and equally special. So, let's go to point three, and we're going to go through this quickly. I did not put letters A, B, and C on your outline, but I'll try my best to articulate them for you. First off, as we go into Genesis chapter 11, verse 10, we see a new section, and once again, we're confronted with lineage. The author has intentionally gone through lineage in chapter 10 and then broke from that to pursue narrative and is now coming back to lineage. Now that the nations have been dispersed, we're now back to looking at offspring, but a very specific offspring. Now, I am not going to read through all of this. However, we see that this is very different than the lineage sequence of chapter 10. If you look at chapter 10, we're tracing the three sons of Noah. And we're kind of looking at all the different sons. We can talk about Ham. He had four sons, Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. And so the author will then start talking about the sons of Cush, and then the sons of Egypt and Put, and all of them. It's not the way it is here in this lineage. There is a direct focus that takes place here in chapter 11. We see a line appear in Genesis 11, 10 through 26 that was not shown in Genesis 10. For instance, we see a name that was disregarded in Genesis 10. What do you think that name is? Well, let's look at it. We're going down to we'll start in verse 14. When Shelah had lived 30 years, he fathered Eber. And Eber lived after he fathered Peleg 430 years and had other sons and daughters. And Peleg had lived 30 years. He fathered Reu. And Peleg lived after he fathered Reu 209 years. When we were in Genesis chapter 10, we came to Eber. We learned that he had two sons, Peleg and Joktan. And who did the author choose to pursue in Genesis 10? Not Peleg, but Joktan or Joktan. And we were left thinking, what about Peleg? Well, now, in Genesis chapter 11, we trace through Shem and we're ignoring Joktan. And we're now pursuing the lineage of Peleg. This is another literary device to emphasize. And the author is going somewhere, but he's going somewhere in a very purposeful way. So there's a different lineage sequence. That would be letter A, but letter B would be a familiar lineage sequence. How is this even familiar? Well, go back to Genesis chapter 5. And I'm not going to read Genesis chapter 5, but this is the lineage of Seth. And if you look at the wording, it's very similar to the wording of the lineage of Shem. And if you look at Genesis chapter 5, the author traces 10 generations from Adam and ends all the way down at Noah. Go back to Genesis chapter 11 and look at verse 10. And here we trace from Shem all the way down to whom? Terah. Well, we could get even more specific. Abram. How many generations do you think there are? 10. We see the author showing through structure once again that he's emphasizing a lineage that comes from Abraham, goes all the way down to Noah, through Shem, through Peleg, and ends at Terah. This is a very familiar lineage sequence. But there's a familiar ending as well. When we finished Genesis 5's lineage sequence, it ended with Noah. And after that, we see the narrative focusing just on Noah. And here in Genesis chapter 11, we see that Terah lived 70 years. He fathered Abram and Nahor and Haran. And what do you think the narrative sequence is going to do now? It's going to focus on these people as well. So, we have actually concluded the first main section of the Book of Beginnings. And folks, believe it or not, we have chronologically covered, would anyone want to guess how many years we've covered? 2,000 years of history. This part of the narrative is sometimes known as primeval history, though filled with many characters and much information, and has at almost lightning speed traveled through 2,000 years of history. However, the text is about to hit the brakes. It's about to slow way down, almost to a standstill. As the past 11 chapters have covered two millennia, the next 25 years will occupy 10 chapters. It's almost as if the world has been waiting for this moment. The arrival of Abram, the 10th from Noah. So folks, next week, we are ending this portion, but we are just starting the look that I believe, or the person that I believe things have been filtering to. And that's Abram, eventually Isaac, Jacob, and we'll continue through this book.